NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Welcome to another edition of Flight Safety Detectives. I'm Miles O'Brien, and I'm joined by an august panel of people who know a lot about aviation and what can go wrong, and more importantly, what we can learn from it. Greg Fife, former NTSB, John Golia, former NTSB, Todd Curtis, former Boeing, and me, I'm just a reporter, but I fly airplanes.
You're just a former.
Just a former guy, but here I am. Okay, so when I was at the former place as the aviation correspondent officially, October 25th, 1999, here's a story you might remember. A Learjet 35 takes off from Orlando Executive Airport, points its nose toward Dallas, Texas, and eventually becomes non-responsive to air traffic control. The aircraft continues to fly, overflies its destination, is intercepted by fighter aircraft along the way. It becomes very clear that the crew is completely incapacitated, unconscious. And eventually, after 1,500 miles of flying, it ran out of fuel over South Dakota and crashed. Now, that in and of itself is an event to remember, but what makes this event something you might have further memory of is that the famous golfer Payne Stewart was the paying customer on board there. The focus of our discussion isn't Payne Stewart or the Lear 35 or jet intercepts necessarily, but the insidious nature of hypoxia, which is a real pilot and passenger killer. And it's a silent killer in so many ways because it's probably more common than you might think. And for pilots, there are many lessons to take on board here as we discuss this. So, Greg, we could go through a number of accidents. A TBM accident in 2014, Rochester to Naples. Pilot becomes incapacitated. His wife, also a pilot, both of them slumped over, intercepted, end up crashing in the Caribbean. The very legendary, the Helios crash 737 in Greece, and which I know you have a lot of knowledge on as you were on the investigation in that case. Japan Airlines 123, the single largest fatality in a single hull crash ever. The pilots didn't, after a breach in the cabin due to the loss of the tail, did not get to a proper altitude, and that was a contributing factor in that crash. It goes on and on. So what's happening, Greg? Why is this problem recurring? Are there some simple things that pilots need to be aware of here?
Miles, I think that, you bring up all of these accidents and there's so many more. We recently had a Cessna Citation that had taken off and ended up flying itself to New York. The airplane wasn't programmed to land at New York, and so it reversed course and flew back. And unfortunately, it too ran out of gas, crashed in Virginia, killed the pilot, very seasoned guy with two passengers on board. And it goes on, like you said. And the question is, why? Well, there's probably a variety of different answers I can give you. From, is it a maintenance issue? Yes and no. As you talked about with a Boeing airplane, the 747, they had a breach in the aft pressure bulkhead. When you look at Payne Stewart, There was discussions about the outflow valve on that particular airplane being a problem. Is that design? Is it maintenance? Is it a combination of both? Then, of course, you got to have the human element. Do you have a pilot who failed to follow a proper checklist or failed to follow the checklist properly, depending on the way you look at it, and forgot to set the pressurization? And so now they take off, they climb to altitude. The cabin, of course, is climbing sky high, and not the airplane isn't pressurizing. The concern here is whether you're flying below 18,000 feet or really actually above 14,000 feet and above 14,000 feet, because there are regulations that require general aviation pilots who are flying airplanes above 12,500 and up through 14,000 feet. There are different requirements for supplemental oxygen. We have a lot of single pilot designed airplanes, especially now, complex airplanes, complex single or turboprop airplanes that are being flown not only in the 20s, but the 30,000 foot level. And time of useful consciousness substantially goes down, of course, the higher you go, but it also depends on the person, their physical condition. And all of these are a combination of factors that lead to a lot of these hypoxia events.
Let's go through this concept of time of useful consciousness is so important. If you're at 20,000 feet, you have 30 minutes or more of what we call useful consciousness, which be, you know, to make decisions and fly an airplane. As you move up in altitude, 30,000 feet, it's 1 to 2 minutes, 35,000 feet, 30 to 60 seconds. You get up into flight level 450, you've got 9 to 15 seconds of useful consciousness. So whatever happens, you got to, if something happens, you have to act quickly. So John, let's start with what, you know, what the regs are. First of all, for airline pilots, if one of your the person in the other seat leaves to use the restroom or whatever, what do the regs say?
The regs say that they need to have oxygen available to them, readily available. But the airline policies that they set themselves require the first officer, whichever pilot remains in the cockpit, to don the mask, to actually put it on. And I know that happens routinely because when those changes came on, we suddenly had to service oxygen much more frequently than we had done in the past. So we know that the crews do that routinely.
So they reach the mask, the quick donning mask, and they put it on, and they actually breathe from that mask, or at the very least have it right below their mouth. I think at a certain altitude, they're supposed to be breathing from it. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that because they automatically fit to you, the harness is spring loaded. So when they put it on, it automatically brings the mask on, so they're breathing in the oxygen.
All right. So has everybody here been in an altitude chamber? Todd, I know you have, right?
I have. And, and the thing about that is it was a safe environment in that, yes, I did feel the effects of hypoxia. In fact, I got a slight case of altitude bends the last time I was in one because I was in the military and they were doing, we were doing a few exercises in there. But the thing that really struck me is that when we're doing it at a fairly low altitude, I think it was 15,000 feet simulated altitude, they said, take off your mask, do these simple things, writing on a board, etc. And I thought, okay, there's nothing much to this. When I looked at it later, it's like, my gosh, it's like I was drunk, but felt like I was totally sober. I was unaware that I was not as capable as I should be. And that's the thing. And some of the accidents we've done, including one or two very recently, when you read between the lines of the report, they don't say it was hypoxia, but you had all the elements of hypoxia. You had a VFR pilot in IFR conditions, climbed up to about 14, 15,000 feet to escape whatever weather condition they were in. They had no equipment on board for the supplemental oxygen, and they were there for about 10 minutes at the 14, 15,000 range before they lost control and had an in-flight breakout. So even though the report didn't specifically say hypoxia, reading between the lines, you're thinking, this is happening frequently in accidents, and there's not enough evidence to specifically say it was hypoxia, but all the clues were there.
Well, what's interesting about it and kind of scary, the insidious nature of this, having been in a chamber myself and experiencing this and couldn't even do 2 + 2 math, I was having a ball. It's basically the same metaphysical thing that is happening when you drink. You're depriving your brain of oxygen. We all like to get a little buzz, right? So my thought going away from it was this would be a very pleasant way to die, frankly. But if you don't want to do it that day, you should be aware of that. And Greg, I think that's probably a real problem here, is that pilots don't necessarily recognize it. They actually feel euphoric. They feel like they know more than they do. They feel on top of their game when they're actually in deep trouble.
Absolutely. And you bring up several good points there. One, I climbed a 21,000 foot mountain when I was investigating an accident down in Bolivia. I did the climb without oxygen. Your body can acclimate to certain amount or certain altitudes in a 24-hour period. That's why people that come from Texas to go skiing out here in Colorado feel sick, they have headaches and that kind of stuff, because they have high altitude sickness. Their body hasn't adjusted to that rapid change. And I experienced, a lot of things when I was climbing the mountain. I wasn't hypoxic or anything like that, but I did have headaches, and that is from that lack of oxygen. But the other thing is I was keeping a journal. And the higher I went, even though I had my wits about me, I was physically fit to be able to go up the mountain and carry a 60-pound backpack. When I would write things, the letters were this big on a piece of paper this big. And it's because, you lose those motor controls. The other thing, when you guys have been in an oxygen, an altitude chamber, just like myself, is your color vision goes away. So if all of a sudden now, things are starting to look black and white or gray, you know that you have this, at least the starting symptoms of hypoxia. And pilots really need to be plugged into this, as well as passengers, but primarily pilots, especially flying these aircraft above 18,000 feet, because you don't have a lot of time. You talked about what the FAA says with regard to the time of useful consciousness. That's under the best of circumstances. But again, as I said earlier, it's all based on your physicality, if you will. Somebody that's younger, yes, their TUC is going to be a lot longer than somebody who's in their 60s or 70s. And so
I want to interrupt and go back to what you said a few minutes ago. You mentioned the accident you investigated, which was, if I remember right, January 1st, 1985, 727 Eastern Airlines at the top of a mountain near La Paz.
Yeah.
You did that without oxygen. That was, I'm doing some math here, 39 years ago. What would be the effect on you if you were as healthy physically, strength-wise, carrying the 60-pound backpack as you were back in 1985? How would you tolerate the lack of oxygen now versus then?
I think, I have a bit of an advantage because I live at high altitude. Where I live right now is at 6,000 feet. So I've got to jump on that. But for somebody coming from the flatlands, or even at my age, I still work out, I still run 5 miles and do all of those things. It will be tougher physically. I know that I'll feel the effects more today than I did back in 1985. But what I learned was what my body feels like under, quote, normal conditions versus what I was feeling as I went up in altitude. My fingers started to tingle. My chest was heavy. It wasn't like I was having a heart attack, but it was just heavy. So I found a lot of different elements that I could recognize when my oxygen levels were low. I didn't have a little pulse ox to be able to, monitor it. So I had to monitor my breathing. And I think for pilots flying at altitude, and even passengers, if they are feeling lightheaded, if they are having a headache, if they feel nauseated, these are the kinds of, precursors to something worse. And that's where, for a pilot doing a self-analysis throughout the flight at those altitudes, consciously thinking about things. I know, Miles, in talking about that TVM accident, in talking with a controller, the pilot had made some errors and that kind of stuff, yet because the controller was busy, didn't really pick up on those insidious cues that the pilot was actually telling him without telling him.
Exactly. It would have been nice if the controller was a little more attuned, and controllers should do that. But, you know, Greg, I think you just hit on a really good idea. You know, through COVID, we all got those pulse ox things. Why put that in your airplane? If you're, you know, single pilot guy flying a TBM or a Meridian at altitude, what an inexpensive safety tool that would be to have
absolutely.
On your finger as you're flying along. You know, John, I was thinking about it. You said in the airlines, they have to don that mask if the other member of the flight crew leaves the flight deck. For single pilot, general aviation pilots, you know, technically, I don't believe the rule requires them to wear the mask when they're alone, which presumably they're alone a lot. Should that change?
No question it should change. But you know what? We skirted a little bit here, the issue that has shown up in a couple of those accidents. So we're flying around at 10,000 feet, and we got a little storm up in front of us, and we want to go over it. You don't want to go into it. You don't. Going down is not going to do you any good, so you want to go up. So now you start tucking, you know, a couple thousand feet higher, and you're flying now at maybe 12,000 feet, 30 minutes goes by, and the storm is building under you. Well, what most people don't realize is that those 30 minutes that you just flew a little bit higher, you've just lowered your blood oxygen. You've depleted it, all right? And now all of a sudden, and we had this in one accident, where it appears the guy scooted up to 15 or 18,000 feet. I forget what it was, right? But he'd been flying for 40 minutes on the edge of requiring oxygen. So guaranteed he is already suffering the effects of it. And the last little bump up was enough to put it over the top and take him out of the
And under the best of circumstances where you don't have the stress of, oh my gosh, my VFR pilot in IFR conditions. Oh my gosh, the storm is building. If you add that stress to the lowered oxygen in your system, it can't be good for you. Whatever it was you had going on will be made worse by the stress.
Yeah, that high stress, high anxiety, where you're rapid breathing. You know, things have changed physiologically. And Miles, I think, you know, before we were on air, we were talking about the effects of hypoxia, or at least the precursors to hypoxia, are more pronounced at night. They have a more impactful outcome at night because, again, it affects your vision. And so it's really important that pilots, and I investigated a Piper Malibu years ago that crashed. They were up at 25,000 feet. The airplane eventually flew itself out of gas and crashed. And one of the things that we found in the investigation was the placement of the supplemental oxygen for the two front seats were on a slide tray underneath the respective seat. And if you read the procedures, instead of using the slide tray for the oxygen system under your respective seat, you actually used the slide tray from the seat next to you. Well, that's the worst thing, because now the last thing you want to do is be bending over.
Right.
You know, and it was very hard, it was very difficult, and it wasn't timely. And so it's really good for pilots who are going to fly their aircraft at high altitude to really understand and be very conversive, not only with the limitations of your own oxygen system, because a bottle, it's a supplemental bottle you throw in the back seat and breathe a cannula, versus a built-in system, have two different limitations. But the other thing is, get in your airplane and practice. If you need to put an oxygen mask on, where is it and how fast can I get it on?
Yeah. Well, a pressurization system on a modern aircraft should tell you if your cabin altitude is rising to a dangerous level. So, of course, things fail. So let's think about some ways that pilots can navigate this, you know, the high altitude world safely. Because what you have with these, you know, these new aircraft coming on are people transitioning from Cirrus SR-22s into these, you know, these TBMs. And if they got the money, a Pilatus or a Meridian, whatever the case may be. But it's a whole different world up there when you're dealing with pressurization and understanding what it can do to your body if it's not working. So the pulse oximeter, I think, you know, what a great simple idea, but there's probably some other ways. What are some other suggestions we could give pilots to make sure they don't get into trouble this way?
Lightspeed has a headset that has it right in your ear. So it'll sense it and put the beep in your ear that you've got a problem.
That's a good idea, because that would be a separate system from the aircraft. So if you had a failure of the system in the aircraft to warn you, then you have some other way of getting a warning out of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing is, you know, you have two different types of depressurizations. You're either going to have a seal, like, let's say, a door seal, you know, starts leaking or fails, and the cabin goes up at not a prescribed rate, but it goes up at a slower rate versus a window blowing out where now you have a rapid decompression. Again, like we talk about in flight training from day one, always be ahead of the airplane. It's one thing to be ahead of the airplane when you're navigating or, you know, anticipating weather or thinking about emergency procedures as far as an engine failure or something to that effect. But for those that are flying airplanes in those high altitudes, in that little scenario you're constantly running through your head, you also have to add in now, if I lose pressurization, what do I need to do? And the first thing is get that oxygen mask on, fly the airplane, make sure you still have oxygen, make sure you still fly in the airplane, and then get it down as soon as you can to a breathable altitude.
Now, as far as what you can do, and talking general aviation here, if you're either a single pilot or you have another qualified pilot, even if it's just a private pilot, not an instrument rated pilot like yourself, how can you leverage what you have if you have someone else up there with you versus what you should do to protect yourself if you're flying alone?
Well, that's a really good point, because that TBM crash we were talking about back in 2014, they were going Rochester to Naples. He was a pretty high time experienced TBM pilot. He was actually the head of the TBM club in the United States. So, you know, very accomplished TBM pilot. His wife was a private pilot with about 400 plus hours. I don't think she had an medical, but that at the very least, she would have, you know, should have recognized this kind of thing. But the problem is what caused his insidious lack of consciousness and euphoria affected her equally. And so they both slumped over at the same time. And that is the fundamental problem. It's hard to check each other in that situation without some other way of warning you.
And that's why, you know, there's been discussion about the airplane talking to you, these, higher technology airplanes, where if you've been sitting there for 30 minutes and you haven't done anything and you haven't keystroked anything on a Garmin 1000 or a Garmin 3000 or any of the other technology that resides in a panel, there's an audio warning that says, do something. It's just to alert the pilot that, okay, I want to make sure as the automation, you're still plugged in here, you're still with me. You know, and it's prompting the pilot to actually do something so that it knows, hey, you know, the pilot is still engaged versus, the pilot hasn't had a keystroke or made a keystroke in 30 minutes. You know, maybe the system now needs to revert to an automated system. So
has this not been a concern and a talking point since the advent of glass cockpit airliners, what, in the early 1980s? How long has this conversation been going on?
Well, it's been the conversation's been going on quite a long time. We have the technology. The question is, who's going to implement it voluntarily versus mandated?
Well, these Autoland systems, which are now emerging, and the Piper products, Cirrus has one, I believe. TBM might have one in their latest and greatest.
Yeah.
You know, which essentially is just an autopilot which never turns off. You know, you're controlling the aircraft, but the George is still with you the whole way. And if you take your hands off, it's going to say, okay, we're just going to bring it down here. And that maybe that's something that should be just, you know, part of every aircraft that is built marching forward that goes up in these high flight level altitudes.
I mean, it's great technology. The technology is there and the cost is not prohibitive, because any kind of avionics package in these airplanes today, you know, are expensive anyway. It's already built in. So it's not like you have to bolt on another $50,000 piece of equipment to make this stuff work, unless, of course, you're trying to retrofit an old airplane. But again, it's there. Let's use it as a tool. It's no good sitting in the toolbox if you don't pull it out of the toolbox and actually put it to use.
It's one thing to have an option for the aircraft. It's like an option on a car. You don't have to have it. It's not required. But if you want to have it, pay a few more bucks. To get to the point where it's mandated, how long of a period would it take to wind its way through the system to get buy-in from all the various industry players who have to get buy-in from before that would become something that's in, you know, notice of proposed rulemaking and a year's worth of comments? Would it be a decade or more before this would be mandated?
Typically, 10 years is what it takes to get a new rule through.
Well, and these airplanes, these old airframes hang around. I'm looking at airplanes now that are 30 and 40 years old to purchase, you know. And so, as you say, it's you don't always have that the latest and greatest technology of these aircraft.
Yeah, I mean, you could mandate it on a forward fit and mandate it for some level of retrofit going back, you know, a certain amount of years. But you can't expect somebody who's flying, a 1963 Piper Comanche who has, you know, still analog equipment to put something like this in. But I think that at least going forward, it's all about pilot awareness and education. We get complacent with this. We don't think about it until it happens. And unfortunately, a lot of times, you don't have time to think about it after it happens because you're probably not going to be around. The fact of the matter is that in this day and age where we are flying higher, we have these technically advanced aircraft that can fly higher. It is incumbent upon a pilot to not only have that self-awareness and be prepped or briefed, just like John preaches at the end of every show about being prepared, and you prepare during the pre-flight. But it's also incumbent upon me as a pilot and the responsibility I have to the people sitting next to me and behind me that are considered passengers to make them aware as well that in the event, or if you don't feel good, or if this occurs, let me know, because they may feel something, hear something. I mean, you know, if you got a door seal and the door is in the very back of the airplane and you got a headset on, you're not going to hear it hissing back there or screaming or singing as a lot of us talk and try to describe. But a passenger may go, man, there's a high-pitched squeal back here that just doesn't stop. That could be an indication for me that, man, I got a door seal that's leaking, you know. I got a pressurization problem. I got to do something.
What role, if any, do you think that your premier schools, your Embry-Riddles, University of North Dakota's, might play in the educational process? That is, the folks going through these very formal programs that take years, having this sort of thing drilled into them where it's not required once they get out there. But what role are they currently playing with this aspect of education? And what role could they play if this is seen as a risk that has to be addressed?
Good question.
I'm going to ask that question. I'm at Embry-Riddle next week, giving a presentation to their aviation folks, and I will ask that question.
Because this is a global business.
It would be nice to see if they are doing something in this area.
U.S. has a central role in educating aviation professionals around the world, and this, I think, is an opportunity to start in a place that has leverage for the future.
Wouldn't it be great if they all had a chance to go in a chamber like we all did and experience it, at least see it coming? So,
well, what an eye-opening experience that was.
It is. How hard is it
for a GA pilot to do that? I mean, I did it in the military, and of course, you were in the role you were in, so that made sense. But if I'm an average GA pilot and I'm going to do a chamber ride, where do I go?
I mean, the military bases do offer, you know, access periodically to their altitude chambers. And part of your high altitude quals or checkouts, you have to go through an altitude chamber. So, I mean, it's out there. It may not be as prevalent as it used to be, but you have to go through it, and it is out there. And I would encourage everybody to do it because you learn about your own physiology. I mean, all four of us, you know, five of us could be in a chamber and we're sitting there looking at each other And of course, Miles is, you know, in his euphoric world, just tearing it up, having a great time, while Todd's already passed out at 25,000 feet, and John's always on cloud nine. So, you know, he can go forever. So, I mean, it's all about recognizing the symptoms, yeah. and then banking those symptoms, going, you know what? As we went through 20,000 feet, I felt like this. As we got to 25,000 feet, I felt like this. And after 2 minutes, I felt like this. That's what you got to park on the hard drive so that you can take that knowledge with you as you go up in altitude, going, I remember when I was in the altitude chamber and I felt this way, you know, that was a precursor to, you know, the hypoxia symptoms. So it is definitely worth the additional education. But again, it's all about pilots taking advantage of not only the tools, but taking the initiative to expand that toolbox, especially if they're going to be flying at these higher altitudes.
I just had a great idea for a business. We should start a chain of altitude bars. This is for people who no longer like to drink. They can go in, you can dial in the altitude, you get the same effects, and yeah. Home you go, right? We'll call it hypoxia. All right. So with that, why don't we get the aviation benediction from the great John Golia?
Well, before I let him have the floor, I'd like to have actually 2 seconds of last words.
Oh, okay.
I'm sitting here, not in a hypoxic state, having ideas, and I got two ideas. One, for those of you who have access to the internet and you like to put the stuff out there, and you've had the experience of going through a chamber ride or going through a hypoxic experience in flight, go online, give yourself a TikTok video, or make one or whatever, share your experience with the people around you. And also, you know, in addition to sharing those experiences, if you have survived a close call, it's like, whew, I felt like I was on edge there and things are kind of squirrely, but I didn't bust any regulations and I survived. My favorite place to put stuff like that, the Aviation Safety Reporting System of NASA. Write up your experience. You know, there I was hypoxic, and here's how I got into it. Here's how I got out of it. Put those things out there because, hey, you know, that's knowledge we can all use.
Well, wait a second here. You bring these two up, and then you want them to post them everywhere else except our website. Send them to Flight Safety Detective so we can hear the stories, we can read the stories, we can talk about the stories on air so that we can share this information of someone's experience so others will learn from it.
Thanks for that marketing tip.
I think we need a built-in live stream at the aviation bar, at the altitude bar, the hypoxia bar, and you know, people just see it all day long. All right, John Golia, the benediction, please.
Hey, please, everybody, if you're going to go flying, do a very thorough pre-planning session at home or the hotel before you leave. Do it again at the airport. Make sure that they agree with one another. When you get out to your airplane, a very, very thorough pre-flight. After you get in the air, put that head on a swivel. We still have reports coming in of near misses. You know, the stuff that's not being reported to the FAA because it really wasn't close enough. But it could have been, absent somebody with their wits about them, short-circuited. So please, please fly safely.
All right, let's end it with that. No better words than that. Thank you, gentlemen, and thank you all for joining us for another edition of Flight Safety Detectives. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.